U.S. House prosecutors wrap up the impeachment case against former President Donald Trump. The Yemeni military says it successfully targeted a Saudi airbase in the kingdom's southwest with a ballistic missile. And Israel is reportedly planning to build a neighborhood including about 250 units for settlers in central Jerusalem, Mount Quds. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in for World News. And now, our top story, Donald Trump's impeachment prosecutors say that the former president should not be allowed to ever hold the top office again.
Dear colleagues, is there any political leader in this room who believes that if he is ever allowed by the Senate to get back into the Oval Office, Donald Trump would stop inciting violence to get his way? Would you bet the lives of more police officers on that? Would you bet the safety of your family on that? Would you bet the future of your democracy on that? President Trump declared his conduct totally appropriate. So, if he gets back into office and it happens again, we'll have no one to blame but ourselves.
Democratic representative was addressing the Senate during the third day of the impeachment trial for inciting a deadly attack on the Capitol building. Raskin said that the assault did not spring into life out of thin air and was in fact in line with the former president's continued pattern and practice of inciting violence. Representative Ted Lieu also argued the former president's lack of remorse since the riot shows he intended the events of January 6th to happen and that such violence could occur again in the future. Earlier, President Joe Biden said the harrowing video evidence of the assault may change some minds.
I think the Senate has a very important job to complete, and I think my guess is some minds may have been changed, but I don't know.
Biden was referring to videos which were presented by the House impeachment managers during the second day of the trial. Footage shed new light on the extent of the attack as it showed how a mob left a pro-Trump rally and then invaded the Capitol building. Trump supporters were seeking to stop the certification of Joe Biden's November 3rd election victory. Mayhem left five people, including a police officer, dead. Democratic impeachment managers wrapped up their case. A conviction requires a two-thirds majority now in the Senate. If convicted, Senate could hold a second vote to disqualify Trump from ever seeking office again. Dwight Reed says the Democrats' likely failure to convict Trump has given rise to speculation that this impeachment trial is mere political posturing.
Tomorrow, starting at noon Eastern time, will be the turn of the lawyers for the Trump defense to take their swing at it. They will have up to 16 hours to present their side of the story, although whether they even want to use that, the entirety of that time remains to be seen. Their presentation of this impeachment trial is that it's kind of a waste of time. So, you know, it may work out for their logic to sort of not even use the sheer amount of time that they have. I think their argument is going to be pretty simple. Donald Trump is no longer president. The argument that we heard from Democrats today, specifically from Joe Neguse, Democratic representative from Colorado, they're focused on three main points. Was violence foreseeable? Did Trump encourage violence? And did Trump act willfully? They say the answer to all three of those questions is yes. They still seem to be 11 senators short of that two-thirds majority, which they would need to convict Donald Trump. Again, leading a lot of observers to speculate that this is kabuki theater.
The Yemeni army says that it has launched a ballistic missile targeting King Khalid Air Base in the southwest of Saudi Arabia. Yemeni Army spokesperson Yahya Sari said, the missile has successfully hit its target air base located near the city of Khamis Mushayat in Asir province. And he added the strike was in response to a recent surge in Saudi-led coalition attacks on Yemen. Sari said the missile was a new type which was used for the first time, and it's the latest in a series of retaliatory strikes by the Yemeni army against Saudi positions in reaction to the kingdom's over 6-year war on the country. Sana'a says its retaliatory strikes will continue until Riyadh stops its devastating attacks, which have killed tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians since March 2015. The European Parliament has called for a European Union-wide ban on arms sales to Saudi Arabia and its allies who are attacking Yemen. In a joint motion, the bloc member states were urged to place an embargo on the export, sale, update, and maintenance of any form of security equipment to the Saudi-led coalition. Motion cited serious breaches of international humanitarian and human rights law committed by the coalition in Yemen. European Parliament also called for EU sanctions against the human rights violators in the Arab country. Motion welcomed Germany's arms sales ban to Saudi Arabia, Italy's ban to both the UAE and the Saudis. Israel is reportedly planning to build new settlement units in the occupied West Bank. An Israeli newspaper said that the new units will be built in central Jerusalem Al-Quds. According to the report, the plan includes the construction of several 24-story buildings, 250 protected units, and hundreds of offices and other facilities. Earlier this week, reports said Israeli authorities were planning to expand the settlement in Jerusalem Al-Quds by 900 new units. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Joining us now out of New York is Rabbi David Feldman, spokesman for Neutrai Karta International. Hello, Rabbi. I hope you're safe and doing well. Your thoughts on more settlement expansion by Israeli authorities?
Well, you know, this is unbelievable. This is just repeating itself each and every time again. As religious Jews, we always say that according to Judaism, this entire occupation is illegal. This entire occupation is anti-God. Stealing and oppressing an entire people is totally criminal. It happens to be that Jewish people are in exile. We are forbidden to have a state of our own. All of this is in total opposition of, in total contrast of Jewish religion. But when it comes to settlements, it goes even so much further. Even those elements that would be willing to compromise are up in arms against these settlements. The entire world is up in condemnation of this illegal settlement movement. It's illegal according to international law, and as I said, according to Jewish law, this is totally forbidden. And it's so sad and so shameful when there is a state calling itself the State of Israel, supposedly representing the Jewish people, all Jewish people, and supposedly in accordance with Jewish tradition and Jewish law, and all of this is totally wrong. Jewish people worldwide are condemning these current attempts of settlement expansion and of this entire occupation.
So if things in the last 60, 70 years unfolded under the precepts and the concepts of true Judaism, how would things look, Rabbi, in occupied territories today?
Well, if it would have been in according with true Judaism, it's not only going to be a change in the settlements. This should be a change in this entire occupation. You know, the government of Israel is not going to listen to what I say or to what so many Jewish scholars say or to what the entire Jewish tradition or the Jewish religion teaches. But if they do choose to follow Judaism, they simply have to stop this entire occupation. We should go back to pre-1948. We have to restore all rights to all indigenous people that lived in the Holy Land. There was a majority of Muslims, there was Christians, and there were Jews. These people lived in peace. We didn't need a state of Israel in order to exist. this false propaganda today that Jewish people need the state of Israel in order to be safe and secure, it's totally the contrast. This is in total contrast to Judaism. It's a violation of Judaism, and it's causing so much harm, so much threat, so much hatred to Jewish people. All of this is unneeded. All of this is tragic. It's a political, it's a game of politics being played on the account of Palestinian Muslims, Jews, and Christians.
Thank you, Rabbi. God bless. Stay safe. Always a pleasure to have you on. Out of New York, that was Rabbi David Feldman, spokesman for Nitrai Carson International. Meanwhile, the French justice minister has asked all prosecutors in France to condemn the BDS movement, which calls for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. But the European Court for Human Rights said last year that boycott movement is in fact legal. So who's right and who's wrong? Our correspondent in Paris takes us along.
These kind of actions calling for the boycott of Israeli products will not be possible anymore if the French Minister of Justice, Dupont-Moretti, succeeds in his intentions. In a letter, he instructed all prosecutors, magistrates, and judges in France to condemn appeals to boycott Israeli products because it is a discrimination against the nation, he says. But an important group of French people reacted publicly, stating that BDS is legitimate and legal. In June last year, the European Court for Human Rights said that boycott is a legal political weapon. Pierre Stamboul is member of the board of the French Jewish Union for Peace and a BDS activist. His father was deported by the Nazis.
In France and in the USA, many Jews are involved in the BDS movement because Israel and the Zionist movement commit crimes against the Palestinians. The Israeli policy is an insult to our memory, our history, and our identity. Today, we see that France is again complicit with Israel. But nevertheless, France has been condemned by the European Court of Human Rights to pay 100,000 euros to BDS activists who organized the boycott action.
For lawyer Dominique Cochin, the judgment of the European Court prevails over the French directives.
C'est-à-dire que la France...
That means that France is committed to respect the judgments of the European Court of Human Rights. Minister Moretti pretends to obey this judgment. It says in Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights that the boycott is a totally legitimate political way of expression. But the French Minister of Justice, with this letter, tries again to criminalize the appeal to boycott.
The appeal to BDS has been launched by the Palestinians in 2005 and had a support all over the world, with remarkable events also in France, with actions in supermarkets or boat protests against the inauguration of a Ben Gurion square. They asked the end of the colonization and occupation of Palestine. The French Minister of Justice would like BDS activists to appear in courthouses to be condemned for criticizing Israel. That will not be easy because most lawsuits against BDS are won by the activists till now. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Iran's foreign minister has called on the U.S. to comply with its obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal before asking Tehran to do so. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said that Washington withdrew from the international accord in mid-2018 and then punished countries which were complying with the United Nations resolution which endorsed the deal. He added that President Joe Biden's administration is still in the same position but keeps talking about Iran's compliance with the nuclear agreement. His comments come amid a standoff between Tehran and Washington, with each asking the other to act first to salvage the joint comprehensive plan of action. Political commentator E. Michael Jones says the goal of the United States has always been to destroy Iran, whether Democrats or Republicans are in power.
The goal has always been to destroy Iran, one way or the other. And I think the Democrats had an idea that if over the long haul, we could simply subvert the entire country with things like the color revolution of 2009, the failed color revolution of 2009. If they could gain time and they could gain access, I think they felt that they could bring about the fall of the revolutionary government. Now, what has happened here is we have 4 years now of a man who came to power, Donald Trump, by telling us he was going to withdraw from the Middle East, never really accomplished that. And in a contradiction to that policy, which was the America First policy, he tightened the screws on Iran and overturned the JCPOA. So the question is, what has happened in this 4 years? What has happened to the Democrats? And it seems to me it should be obvious that when Biden got in, he should overthrow all of Trump's policies. But apparently there's hesitation now. So whether the Democrats have now gone over to the hard line, the Likudnik hard line, is something that we have to anticipate here. Maybe this is the change that's taken place over these 4 years.
Massive inflation, unprecedented price hike triggered violent protests in Pakistani capital Islamabad. Javed Rana reports.
The clashes between the police and the government employees in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The security forces use excessive tear gas to prevent opposition-backed protesters who government fears could have besieged country's parliament. They demanded the government to raise their salaries by 40% to compensate them over massive price hike and inflation after Pakistan devalued its currency under an intense IMF pressure.
Tear gas and the lathi charge, that is really shameful because we are not terrorists. Our salaries should be increased, should be competitive because when Imran Khan government took charge, inflation rate, you can see 300% inflation rates has been high and increased during the previous 2.5 years. And we are still, the PTI government has not increased even 1% our salaries in the last budget.
The protests by the government employees disrupted the usual official business across the country at a time when the mainstream opposition parties joined hands against Prime Minister Imran Khan's government to oust him from power over alleged rigging in 2018's general elections.
We condemn the brutal violence on government employees. It is incredible to see such excessive use of force against the government employees. If they do not work in their offices, the government business would come to a grinding half. Will Imran Khan alone run the government?
Fearing the politicization of the protest, a better sense prevailed, and Prime Minister Imran Khan's government apologized with the protesting employees of the government and finally successfully negotiated with the leaders of the employees' union to end their protest. The government has announced to increase a 25% raise in their salaries. The troubles for the government are far from over. The mainstream opposition parties are all set to start a long march from all over Pakistan to capital Islamabad next month. However, with the end of the protest of employees, the government has managed to contain the crisis from being aggravated ahead of a long march. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
China has banned the broadcast of BBC World News, accusing it of giving fake and biased reports. A government spokesman, or statement, I should say, said that BBC's China-related reports seriously violate broadcast guidelines and harm China's national interests. And that comes a week after the British regulator banned the Chinese broadcaster CGTN over licensing problems. Ban has provoked UK's condemnation, with the country's foreign secretary Dominic Raab calling the move an unacceptable curtailing of media freedom. Beijing and London are at odds over several issues, including Britain's ban on Chinese telecom giant Huawei and the situation in Hong Kong. Turkey says it will not turn back on its deal for the Russian S-400 missile systems, despite opposition from Washington. Presidential spokesman Ibrahim Kalin said a dispute with the U.S. on the issue can be resolved through dialogue. However, not that quick solutions. He noted that quick solutions cannot be expected, though. Washington's imposed sanctions on Turkey following its acquisition of the missile systems. Says the Russian missile system poses a threat to its F-35 fighter jets and to NATO's broader defense systems. Turkey, though, rejects that, saying the Russian-made missile systems will not be integrated into NATO. Thanks for joining us, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Residents of Homsa al-Fawqa have repeatedly had their homes in the Jordan Valley destroyed by Israeli regime forces, says Satha Hamad, a journalist, in an article published under the heading "Israeli Regime Village Demolition Leaves Palestinian Families Desperate and Homeless." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Aisha Abu Awad, 57, sat in front of a demolished tent that once constituted her family's home in the Palestinian community of Homsa al-Fawqa. With practically no shelter from the winter weather, she held tightly to her youngest granddaughter, 3-month-old Manar, who is also the youngest newborn in the community. As the cold wind intensified and storms approached, the pair could do nothing but wait for a new tent to be erected. On February 1st, the Zionist regime army demolished and confiscated a number of homes and tents in the Bedouin community, which lies in the occupied West Bank's northern Jordan Valley. The army completed the demolition process on February 3rd, following a period of 3 days in which they demolished 70 shelters and tents, some of which were homes and some used for livestock, which locals depend on as their main livelihood. 11 Palestinian families, consisting of close to 80 individuals, including more than 40 children, were displaced, and they no longer have a home or safe shelter this winter. It is not the first time the army has demolished Homsa al-Fawqa. The entire community was knocked down as recently as November 2020. The residents rejected the army's attempts to forcibly deport them and rebuild their homes. The army also regularly raids the area under the pretext of military exercises and temporarily displaces the residents for several days. So far, the families have been evacuated 11 times. Aisha, who moves around with difficulty, suffers from back pain that intensifies in the cold. The community has become rubble. The Israeli regime army came and destroyed all of our homes and tents, Aisha told the reporters. We are now in the open, between the ground and the sky. She is a mother of 4 children and 8 grandchildren. The eldest of the newest generation, Amid, has not yet turned 6, while the youngest are Manar and 7-month-old Hadil. Running around their demolished homes, children played and tried to collect their toys from underneath the wreckage. Aisha observed them intensely and called on them every once in a while to check that they are okay. I fear greatly for these children. We are unable to provide them with safety today, or even the ability to protect them from the cold, she said. We have no alternative but to remain here on our land. They will continue to demolish, and we will continue to build and remain steadfast here. Thunder began to light up the sky over the demolished community. Minutes later, the wind intensified and the first raindrops began to fall. The children continued to play, unaware of the difficult night that lay ahead for themselves and their families. Amal Abu Kabash, 25, paced around to collect some blankets and hide them under the destroyed tent. They're trying to make life difficult for us and to surround us from all sides. Life here has become almost impossible. Despite all that, we continue to remain here, he told reporters. Walking among the destroyed tents, 52-year-old Muhammad Abu Awad appeared tired, deeply sad and angry. My family of 18 is out in the open today, he said. There is no longer a tent to protect us from the cold and to bring us together. Since the demolition, the Israeli regime army has set up roadblocks in the vicinity of Homs al-Faqa, preventing water tanks and tents from reaching us and confiscating the belongings we tried to bring in. He said that the Israeli regime intended to make Homs al-Faqa, which extends over 60,000 dunams, that is 60 square kilometers, an area completely empty of Palestinian residents, in order to build settlements on it. On February 4th, a Palestinian Authority delegation headed by Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed al-Shatayeh and a number of diplomats and international human rights institutions visited to Homs al-Faqa as a form of solidarity. A group of Israeli regime army and intelligence vehicles closely monitored the event. A military checkpoint was set up at the entrance to the community and all vehicles entering the area were subjected to searches. Our hope is that this solidarity will be real and will not end today, and that it will turn into an act that supports our presence here. Not just a show before the media's camera, said Abu Awad. He pointed out that the community's location in a remote and marginalized area meant that the army could carry out its policies against them quietly. The presence of others around us protects us and draws attention to what is happening to us here, and we hope that this will be a deterrent to the Israeli regime army and expose its actions to the world, he said. Aisha is less optimistic. Everyone will leave, and we will remain alone facing this reality each day and fighting it alone, she said. Murad Eshtawi, head of the Wall and Settlement Resistance Committee office in Northern West Bank, told reporters that the Zionist regime army had demolished several tents that were rebuilt by a group of activists who have been present with the community since February 1st for support. The army also confiscated 9 vehicles belonging to activists and residents as a way to deter them. Eshtabi emphasized that the continuous demolition of Homs al-Faqa was not merely a punitive act that the Zionist regime army had only just carried out, but rather a process of forcible displacement that seeks to empty the area of the Palestinians. Today, the Zionist regime army is targeting Homs al-Faqa, but this policy will also affect the rest of the Palestinian villages and communities in the Jordan Valley, as the Israeli regime seeks to annex the area, which constitutes a third of the West Bank and includes its most fertile lands.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent and the most merciful. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and we are here to present you in another episode of The Muslim Lady. If you remember, dear listeners, we have discussed so many issues regarding a Muslim lady, different issues related to family, related to personal issues, related to social issues, related to, you know, marriage issues. So today also, because of Hazrat Fatimatu Zahra, Salamul Alayha, we are going to continue the hadith which we presented in the last episode, the beautiful hadith of Fatimatu Zahra Salamullah Alayha regarding our meal time.
Yeah, and I'm here also, Razi and Ajafi, and I'm so happy and glad to be with you listeners with this gift of Lady Fatimatu Zahra Salamullah Alayha. This is a beautiful gift because, you know, what she has left for us, this is a treasure, light, nur, you know, it's truly shining our life, day-to-day life, inshallah.
So let me recap. In okay. Our previous episode, we mentioned that
very
in
briefly.
This beautiful hadith, Fatimatu Zahra Salamullah Alayha mentioned that there are 12 things very important while sitting in our dining table, meal time. So four of them we have discussed. That were Marifah, the awareness, and
Rida,
the satisfaction, and
Tasmiya,
and
means saying Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and Shukr.
These and four things were important and wajib upon every Muslim.
Yeah, wajib means it's necessary, mandatory.
Arba'un fiha sunnah. The continuation of hadith says, and what four things are sunnah?
Number one.
Yeah.
I think everyone will be surprised. Yeah. That is wuzu.
Falwuzu qabla at-ta'am.
Exactly.
It's amazing. Because normally we do wuzu for our ibadat, for namaz, for prayers only. Another point, this hadith shows that how beautiful is our Islam,
And you know, the hukm of wuzu has come in Quran in Surah Ma'idah.
Wow,
you know, Surah Ma'idah says you have to do wuzu. Ma'idah means dining table. That is a beautiful connection.
What a beautiful connection between Ma'idah and doing wuzu before Ma'idah, before starting your meal. Al-julus alal janib al-aysar. This is also a new thing from our listener.
First we have to know, then we will practice. We don't know why we should sit, you know, in such a position that our weight...
Body weight should be upon our left side, more than right side.
And we can remember our Lady Fatimatu Zahra Salamullah Alayha, you know, in each mealtime. We can thank her that, you know, we have such a beautiful mother. It's better to eat with our hands, you know, not with spoons, but three fingers. We can start it from our home, then slowly, slowly in our family gatherings, inshallah. I know it's not easy nowadays. The last one, which is sunnah and recommended, is la'iq al-asabi'. Means what?
To clean your fingers with your mouth and
until
clean
the
our
end.
Fingers.
You know, you are not wasting even one single tiny drop or, you know, like nothing get wasted. The last part of this hadith says about manners. So look at the, you know, the way Bibi, Lady Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, she's dividing in portions. One is farz, one is sunnah, and one is adab, ta'adib. So manners, now it comes to manners. So you are sitting on a dining table with so much love, awareness, happiness, satisfaction. Oh, everything goes to your benefiting yourself. Now, adab, manners are like you're respecting others' rights.
Others' rights, yeah.
So what are the manners?
The first is al-aklu bima yaliq. The eating from just in front of your own, you know, portion, from your own plate, from the part which is very near to you.
Not jumping here and
jumping
there.
Jumping and, you know, taking your hands in front of other people and taking those things.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. We shouldn't be so much greedy, you know, the greedy eyes. so that is opposite of the good attitude.
Unfortunately, nowadays, you know, when we are in the dining table, it looks like we are here to, you know, for competing each other too, especially in social gatherings and, you know, public dinings. Everybody tries to get the tastiest food and the most beautiful part of the food.
Especially in the gatherings, you know, we have to respect others' portion too. Yeah. Like you take whatever they put in front
they
of
have
you.
Given
and
in front of you.
Exactly. So akl bima yaliq wa tasghiru luqma. That is the second one.
Yeah, this is also very important. It also relates to our own health also, because scientifically they always emphasize that you take small bites and chew properly, you know. Even Islamically also we have traditions. They say that you take small bites and each bite you chew for at least 20 seconds, 25 seconds, which helps in your digesting system, good digest.
And
so it also belongs to others' rights also. If you take big bites, you know, it's...
And you don't look like respectful.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't goes with these beautiful manners of Bibi Fatma Zahra.
Sometimes maybe it is not, you know, it looks ugly for other people, you know, pouring things from your mouth out, which looks so this is the second thing. And
third one is muzgh shadid,
as I said,
like not only you have to chew nicely,
properly
shadid, you know, it has emphasized. And I'm licking in this area because I take tasghir, I take small
like
bites
this.
But I swallow it very fastly. I don't know, maybe I'm in a hurry position. So it shows like we have to prolong our sitting on the dining table. You know, according to hadith, as much as time you're spending with family on dining table,
it's
Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala will not count.
In your age. Means it will not
count
be counted.
In our age.
For example, if you spent in whole your life 10 years in dining table, that 10 years are not counted from you. Not counted means Allah will not take accountability of these 10 years. You know?
It's a big ease.
It's a big discount.
Very big discount. We don't realize it.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
If I sit with a very different perspective on the dining table, I'm first of all, I'm in a good mood. Yeah. I'm not complaining because most of the time, you know, family time is meal time. When you sit on meal, you have so many things to share. You're just complaining about kids and about, you know, family and about other issues. Maybe if you are in a joint family system, maybe you're talking about, you know, yeah, mother-in-law and father-in-law. So no complaining time, you know, time of gratitude, happiness, pleasure. And all this pleasure comes from Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. So enjoy our mealtime by chewing nicely our food. And the last one?
Chewing nicely, you know, helps, you know, it reduces the work of your stomach, you know, which means that it helps in your, you know, to make your stomach healthy. And if you will have a healthy stomach, which will have less work, so it will work for longer time. So by chewing nicely and taking small bites, you are helping your own health.
And in, sometimes I think that we have to do a long sajda for thanking Allah Tabaraka wa Ta'ala for slaiwa. You know, we don't know the importance of slaiwa. Bibi Fatma Zahra, salamullah alayha, she's saying, look at the, you're this blessing, you know, use it, let it come. If you chew more, the slaiwa is
as
more.
As much as you will chew, you will get more slaiwa. If you get more slaiwa, the more slaiwa you get, the more good digestive system you will have.
And
if you have good digestive system, so it will guarantee your health. So if you have good health, you can become a good abid, worshipper of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala without any problem.
Yeah, I think we need to practice to sit, to, you know, apply this treasure of saying of Lady Fatma Zahra salamullah alayha in our daily life, inshallah. The last part.
And the last part is wa qillatun nadari fi wujuhin nas. Especially if you're sitting on a dining table where other people's guests are sitting, it is not good to see on others' faces. You know, you just focus upon your own food and upon your own plate. Because if you look at others, maybe while eating, you know, their faces are not good, you know, shape.
Yeah.
This is not good also.
And comfortable.
The other thing, especially if you are host, you know, the guests, they do not feel comfortable.
That is a good point. Make them very, very comfortable. They can eat whatever and, you know.
Like we have in Hadith that Imam Ali, he used to, you know, blowing some candles, the light, so the guest can feel comfortable and eat easily, you know, especially, you know, when their food is less. Because in those times they had the problem of food, so the guest cannot understand that, you know, host has eaten, is eating or not, so he eats just
whatever he wants.
Look at these specific and small details which Islam emphasizes.
That is out of our imagination. Like qillatun nazar fi wujuhin nas, make them feel very, very comfortable. And also, I think like focusing point is also very, very important. Even in Quran, we have hadith wal yanzur al insan ila ta'ami. Like we have to see about our food. We have to ponder from where, how. So if you are talking too much while eating and looking to each other, then you will not, you know, reach to this level of pondering, reflecting. So one is that point. Like as much as we think about each sentence of Lady Fatma Zahra salamullah alayha's hadith, we get deeper and deeper, you know, like different kind of aspects we can learn in our daily life. So it's truly amazing that the manners of Lady Fatma Zahra salamullahi alayha, which she's teaching to us, the manners of dining table, is that we have to focus. For focusing, we have to see whatever is in front of us, number one. Number two, we have to make a very tiny, small, you know, like bites and enjoy each bite, you know, like think about it and then chew nicely and then just focus whatever you are doing. And we can, it doesn't mean that you are not enjoying your mealtime. No, it means you're enjoying genuinely, like truly, like you, the true. Nowadays, you know, people are, I don't know, looking for enjoyment, for pleasure, and they're going towards wrong and false and artificial
and
enjoyment.
Time-wasting, you know, activities to get enjoyment.
They think, you know, if I watch TV or screen and eat, I will enjoy more. If they think if we eat big bites, we'll enjoy more. You know, we have to change our mindset that the true enjoyment is that you're chilling with your family or with your friends, but it doesn't mean that you have to look at them, you have to talk too much, and you have to like eat big bites. No, you can sit humbly. You know, there are so many other benefits. When you eat small bites, you eat less. You know, the
also,
weight problem and digestion problem,
you get
all the problems.
Most benefits by eating less food. If parents act upon these, you know, small, you know, rules and manners, their children also automatically they learn.
Oh, yeah, I
and
remember.
Slowly, you will have a healthy family.
Healthy
habits.
I remember once a Canadian great alim, he was telling us that, if we only teach our children how to chew food, that would be the best inheritance and heirs which we are giving to them. You know, I love it. Many years back, he told us this. Yeah, alhamdulillah.
Because this is a thing daily, 2-3 times we do, and it totally our health depends on it. So this is a very fundamental and very essential rule in our life. So we can talk a lot of episodes, you know, about this hadith. So, but unfortunately, we have short of time. I hope our listeners have enjoyed, as 100%. We did enjoy ourselves learning from these beautiful ahadith of Fatimah al-Zahra salamullah alayha. Until next episode, wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
42 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the grassroots movement of the Iranian Muslims continues its enlightening task of awakening the masses in the region and beyond. It has imparted to them the concept of self-dignity, thereby forcing global arrogance to realize that it cannot defeat even an unarmed nation and barehanded people that are fully determined to achieve their goals and unwilling to accept the hegemony of the domineering powers. Dear listeners, these words were part of an article written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading Resistance Resulting in U.S. Defeats All Over the Region. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. While celebrating the 42nd anniversary of the resounding triumph of the Islamic Revolution, we can say with confidence that as Iran marches steadily towards the pinnacle of progress in all spheres, the future appears brighter than ever. For a nation that has successfully defeated all the plots unleashed by its foe, the U.S., over the past four decades, including the dream of the devils to destroy the Islamic Republic and assemble in Tehran to re-establish American hegemony, we feel indebted to the spirit of resistance breathed to the nation by the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, and his worthy successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Indeed, Iran has come a long way for those memorable days of 1979, and despite the intensification of the illegal American sanctions coupled with the cowardly killing of the icons of our defense and development, General Qasem Soleimani and Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, among other astounding achievements, we are proud of manufacturing the antidote for the coronavirus pandemic, which our principal enemy has so far failed to produce. A glance at the past 42 years reveals the declining power of the U.S. and its clients in the region. The retarded minds in Washington wanted to block the export of the Islamic Revolution, which Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, had described as bursts of light. They have clearly failed, and God willing, in the near future will be totally shoved out of the entire region. They and their clients are not only abhorred by the Iranians, but hated by all other countries, as is evident by the developments in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, Bahrain, Arabia, Palestine, Egypt, Libya, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Turkey, etc. Among the objectives of the Islamic Revolution is resistance against arrogance powers and their oppression. The campaign against arrogance stems from Islam's opposition to any type of oppression against others or yielding to oppression. In other words, on the one hand, Islam opposes oppression against others, and on the other hand, it advises people not to yield to oppression and fight it. Ayatollah Khamenei has correctly analyzed the hostility of global arrogance against the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic of Iran, saying that the U.S. is the most manifest example of oppression. He has pointed out that the enmity and plots against Iran and the Iranian people, started from the very day of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The enemies were and still are the U.S. and the illegal Zionist entity, since both had been deprived of their vested interest in the region. With the fall of their most subservient ally, the British-installed Pahlavi regime. The Islamic Revolution of Iran, with its stand against domestic despotism and foreign hegemony, presented the greatest challenge to the domineering powers. No wonder the ideals of the Islamic Revolution instilled in not just the Iranian people, but the people of the region, the lofty values of Islam as a practical way of life in the modern era, such as social justice and of refusal to yield to the exploitative powers. This obviously made the political equations of global arrogance go awry. This was the reason the U.S., instead of waking up to the realities, adopted a completely hostile attitude to the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic of Iran, along with its accomplices in Western Europe and the Third World, in the vain hope of overthrowing the popular religious system of government in Iran. The U.S., finding Islamic Iran firm and steadfast despite its pressures and plots, is now trying more idiotic tricks that are bound to fail as well. The graver the plots of the U.S., the stronger has become the spirit of resistance of the Iranian Muslim people, making the U.S. lose hope in reimposing its hegemony on Iran, although it has not given up its plots against the Iranian people. As pointed out recently by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, the intensity and multiplicity of threats against Iran actually shows the power of the Islamic system and how it defeated these intricate conspiracies hatched by the U.S. Today, 42 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the grassroots movement of the Iranian Muslims continues its enlightening task of awakening the masses in the region and beyond. It has imparted to them the concept of self-dignity, thereby forcing global arrogance to realize that it cannot defeat even an unarmed nation and barehanded people that are fully determined to achieve their goals and unwilling to accept the hegemony of the domineering powers.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.